whether or not a CMS is required from the perspective of you're spending a lot of time hooking these systems into your static designs. But if they're never being used and the client isn't any more the wiser, you're effectively leaving money on the table by spending that time hooking it in.
From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, Ben Furphy is on the show to discuss whether a site even needs a CMS. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is brought to you by Mithra 62's Backup Pro, a complete backup solution for WordPress, Expression Engine 2 and 3, Craft, PrestaShop, and Concrete 5. We use this one ourselves for some of our client sites. It's insanely customizable and includes automated backup integrity, 8 built-in storage locations, console routing. Basically, Backup Pro was built to make disaster recovery as painless as possible. Just visit backup-pro.com to get started.
This month marks our 6th year podcasting. And whether you're a new listener or have been around since the EE podcast days, you know we love content management systems. CMSs are a cornerstone of the show and even our business. But one topic we haven't addressed is when a CMS isn't needed or isn't a good fit. And I'm not talking about specific software. I'm talking about a CMS, period. So joining us in this discussion today is Ben Furphy. Ben is a front-end developer who has worked for agencies, for himself, and now works for BICMO, an insurance company that specializes in protecting sports equipment like bicycles. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, Ben, why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, so as you said, front-end developer. I've worked for a number of agencies, which myself, and as you said, I now work for a startup, pretty much handling all the front-end stuff for them. Before that, I worked as a journalist, so it was a bit of a leap. Mm. And a lot of my experience with CMSs came before I was necessarily building websites with them. So whether or not that has jaded my opinion of them, I don't know. But it's but other than that, like you said, working for a startup that's focused on extreme sports, obviously I really enjoy getting out there, cycling. I haven't done a lot of kayaking since I moved back from the Middle East. But yeah, it's one of those things I've sort of always enjoyed doing, being outdoors and getting away from the computer.
Nice. So you mentioned you were a journalist and it was a bit of a leap. How'd that leap come about to get into the web?
So I'd been doing a little bit of web development before that. I did work experience back in 2000 at the local council and flitted around various departments. And one of the departments I ended up at was the IT department, who probably fortuitously told me, if there's one thing that I could recommend, it's learn HTML and CSS. Mm. So, sort of dove into that a little bit. You know, as much as I enjoyed it, obviously that was the tail end of the browser wars. So, sort of there wasn't a great amount of documentation around and it was frustrating to try and get stuff done when, we don't have the community of people putting out amazing tutorials and sort of having great podcasts that there are these days. So sort of got to a point where I was a bit frustrated with it and decided that I wanted to indulge my other passion at the time, which was video games, and thought, how can I make a living playing video games? So I spoke to a couple of people and pretty much was pointed towards video games journalism. So luckily I can write. It wasn't just sort of trying to blag it as I went along. but yeah, ended up doing that for about 4 years before going into more sort of IT's sort of business publications. And yeah, did that for a couple of years, moved all around the world for that. As I said, worked in the Middle East for 3 years with a couple of magazines and then pretty much got to a point where there was a couple of personal things that happened. My dad passed away. That sort of made me reevaluate how where I was living and the fact that I'd been away from home for so long. And decided to sort of look at alternatives of what I could do. And so back in sort of late 2012, early 2013, I pretty much decided to pick back up on the web development and see what I could do.
Hmm. And since you've picked it back up, has it been something that you are enjoying more than you did in the earlier days when you didn't have the kind of resources available, or is it still just a constant? I sometimes feel like it's a constant effort to stay on top of what's going on.
It's definitely a constant effort to stay on top. But I think having been a journalist, I sort of thrive on that. I would actually say that there's less pressure to keep on top of things as a front-end developer than there is as a journalist. You know, I would frequently go on holiday for 2 weeks and come back and felt like I'd been asleep for a year as a journalist. And even within relatively, you know, sort of tame industries like sort of high-end IT. But being a front-end developer today, yeah, as you said, you need to keep on top of things. But I enjoy the challenge. It's a little bit more rewarding than just try to keep on top of press releases and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking a bit of your writing, this episode was inspired by an article you wrote and shared with us about whether a small business really needs a CMS. And before we get into that specific discussion, could you explain what a CMS is to you as a developer, and even maybe how that's evolved from your earlier experiences when you said you'd worked with CMSs, but not really as a developer?
Yeah, sure. So for me, a content management system is anything that gives people the ability to interact with a website without necessarily needing to know code. Now, you know, obviously, as we all know, that doesn't really exist. That's sort of like the holy grail of content management systems. Whether it's, you know, something as simple as what I had in the early days when I was a journalist, of learning that, you know, sort of the B tag made things bold, which kind of says how long ago it was, now that it's strong. And that, you know, obviously the I tag made it italic, you know, you made it underlined, all the way to learning about a couple of other things. You know, there's no real way of, you know, sort of doing a website without having some level of technical knowledge. But, you know, going back to the question of what a CMS is, for me, like I said, it's anything that gives somebody whose primary job isn't involved in the web industry an ability to actually edit and manipulate a website.
So is this definition different when you're speaking to clients? Do you even explain to them what it is?
It depends. I mean, you know, you've got kind of make a judgment call when you first speak to a client of how technologically savvy they are. I think the demystifying the web episodes that you've done recently have been great in terms of letting, you know, sort of people knowing, and I agree 100% with what you've said in those, that, you know, it's, you've got to weigh people up and sort of anticipate what they do and don't know. And even if they do know things, sort of take it back, because sometimes it feels very much like people have swallowed a thesaurus of, you know, sort of web design terms and just vomited it back onto a page. So it's sort of trying to avoid the technical terms. It's more about trying to identify what it is that they need to do with that site. You know, what is it that their current website isn't doing for their business that, you know, they have as a goal, or, you know, sort of an aspiration, and sort of steering them towards sort of trying to find out what it is from a business perspective that they need, and sort of trying to avoid, like I said, any sort of technical discussion of things like content management systems or HTML and CSS.
So I guess in the flip side of a CMS would be a static site. So there's a CMS driven site and a static site. Can you sort of describe what you consider a static site?
Yeah, so I think the thing that I was talking about in that blog article was very much sort of a static site from the sense of, one, a site where you can actually touch the files. Effectively, the files themselves actually exist on a server. Obviously, you can't literally touch them, but you can open them up. You can see, you know, whether you're using sort of a little bit of PHP to put in a header and a footer, or whether you are literally writing the code for each page entirely per file. For me, it's sort of that type of thing. So an absolutely hard-coded website where, you know, there's no database, there's no you know, sort of a very, very limited amount of PHP being done. That makes it extremely quick, extremely simple, and that you can basically get out as quickly as possible, and sort of more than anything get the technical things that come along with choosing a CMS and working with a CMS out of the picture, so you can focus on their business need and make sure that you're actually addressing that rather than thinking about a technical problem.
And so, I mean, to me, a static site is basically what we might call old school, though I don't mean that it's not something that makes sense today. I just mean that before we realized we could tap into a database, we might have been hard coding all of these pages, or I think maybe even it might have been Macromedia and maybe Adobe bought it, but there was something called Contribute, and it wasn't really a CMS. It was just sort of like a WYSIWYG to let clients create pages, but they were essentially static pages. They weren't dynamic in the sense of creating entries that would just be populated through a database connection.
Yeah, exactly. That's the sort of approach. And, you know, it's one of those things, you know, I think as we sort of joked prior to getting this thing up and running, one of the number one problems with small businesses is getting them to pay anything for maintenance. You know, having a static site kind of takes that out of the equation. I mean, if, you know, sort of looking back over the, you know, say 10 years I've worked with sites that have got some form of CMS, almost always the attack or, you know, the damage is done to a database or done through a database. So it's that type of thing of, you know, if these people aren't going to pay for maintenance, then you've got to, you know, sort of protect them at the end of the day, because otherwise it's your reputation on the line. But equally, you know, by sort of taking that out of the equation, it makes things simpler. It means that you can actually, you know, sort of focus on, like I said, what the business need is without necessarily having to worry about even training them to some extent.
So for these clients that you go with a static site, is it that maintenance / security angle that is what you use to decide if that's the fit? And is that part of a discussion with the client? And then kind of from that, if they don't want to pay to maintain like their CMS, keep it up to date, get help with maintaining a database driven system, what happens when they want to update their website? Like they have to update something on their website.
Yeah, effectively what, sort of take the first bit when it comes to, you know, sort of addressing sort of it from a security angle. The security is really sort of aside. It's not really the main reason. One of the agencies I worked that had, I think, somewhere in the region of about 30,000 customers over 10 years. And the vast majority of these were ones that were like, you know, sort of small B&Bs or, you know, sort of handyman services. And the reality is that these guys who had static sites that were 8 years old, they were still doing what they needed them to do. Okay, they weren't mobile responsive, but, you know, the only thing they ever needed changing on them was maybe their contact number or their location address. And, you know, it's sort of, it comes down to that thing of, for me, when I start speaking to a customer or when I started speaking to a customer, it was always a case of looking at what they've done with the website. I think Jack McDade in his content workflow interview made a great point, which is how many times have we seen clients demand that they have to have a website that's editable, have a blog, and then 3 years down the line, you go back to the website and they've got, it's still the only post and the only thing that's been, you know, sort of editable on the site is that, hey, look, welcome to our brand new website. You know, it's sort of looking at what they've done in the past and actually realistically saying to them, look, guys, you haven't actually done anything to the website. Is that because you couldn't? Is that because there really wasn't anything for you to do? You know, why would actually being able to edit the website help you achieve your business goals? You know, it might be that they were given a blog last time. The blog's quite a generic, ambiguous thing to a lot of people, and they think, oh, you know, what am I meant to blog about? Am I meant to blog about what I have for dinner? Well, it's not necessarily about that. It's about more maybe sort of moving away from that sort of conversation about, oh, I need a blog, to, well, actually what you're looking to do is provide confidence to people who've come to your website that you can supply the service. So let's, rather than having a blog, we'll have a case studies or a, you know, a customer stories section, which is effectively, for all intents and purposes, treated like a blog, where they sort of update that type of, you know, sort of update the site doing that. But it's very much a case of looking at what their capabilities are as well. A lot of these guys are, you know, sort of either sole traders or, you know, sort of the sweet spot for me was always somebody who had at least one employee, but weren't big enough to have a marketing person. And because of that, it meant that very few of them ever had time to, short of sitting down and spending their valuable evening, you know, writing stuff. They very rarely ever had time. So it meant that you could come up with, you know, sort of packages that focused on giving them the ability to have, you know, a content writer or myself or somebody else write up that content for them and post it. And in that sense, do, you know, the question becomes, does the client need a content management system? Because of course, that's the sort of flip, is does the client need a content management system? If you've done a deal with the client, do you need a content management system to manage the site and stuff? It's very much about like touching on those type of topics and sort of, you know, working that out, because it might be the case, and as I've discussed with a couple of people in the last week after sort of highlighting that the topic was going to be on the show, a lot of them have quite validly pointed out that their clients never touch the content management system, but they do, or their, right. you know, their,
right.
might be their virtual assistant touches it, which is a perfectly valid point. But as far as the client's concerned, they haven't got a content management system.
So I guess these would have to be questions that you're having during the sales process.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's no, I think it's one of those things, one of my personal bugbears, and it's something that I've talked to people about before, is when I've spoken to clients in the past, they always say that it's refreshing that I've actually taken the time to take a step back and look at their business. A lot of the web developers that they've spoken to have immediately started going, oh, we can get this WordPress theme, or, you know, this design is going to be perfect for you. And having those type of discussions at that point is completely the wrong approach. And I think it's one of the reasons why some web developers come across as unprofessional, because it's coming across to people who've got no technical knowledge and quite frankly, no desire to learn it, as, you know, you're suddenly going into talking about technical stuff. As far as they're concerned, that's what they're paying you to do. They don't want to have to worry about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think that when more and more developers think about the business perspective first before the technical perspective, that naturally ends up people thinking whether or not a CMS is even necessary. But I'm a little bit curious. I want to take a step back and ask a technical question, because we've been defining static sites and CMSs, but there's kind of an almost like an in-between, which is a static site generator. Is that a type of CMS?
Yeah, I'd say a static site generator is definitely a type of content management system, whether it's the type of one you would ever want to put in front of a client.
Right.
Mm. I genuinely don't know. I mean, obviously, you've got probably the highest profile example is the old healthcare.gov website. I think was set up for Obamacare. I'm not 100% sure about that. But obviously, I think that was built on Jekyll.
Oh, interesting.
It had it was a Jekyll or something similar to that, but it was static. And they had an interface, and I can't remember what it is. I'll pass the link over to you for the show notes, where it was basically a website that gave them the ability to make edits to the GitHub repo without needing to know anything about version control. It basically, when they created a new post, I think it used Gitflow to set up a new feature, and then that was sort of edited. And if they wanted to have some sort of editorial control, it could be saved as, you know, sort of the end of the feature and then put into a release, and the release would be checked by the editor. And if that was okay, then it was approved and sent up. So yeah, static site generators are a type of content management system. I wouldn't necessarily say they were static in the sense, you get a lot of the benefits of a static site in terms of speed and security, but they're not, I wouldn't quite say exactly static.
And so I have not used anything like this. I've only heard about it and basically what you just shared. And so there's no real quote unquote control panel like we are used to with a content management system. It's just sort of, I guess, like wizards that are helping Git update a system?
It depends. I mean, if you are a developer that's using it straight off the bat, then it's been a while since I've used one. So if I do get this wrong, feel free to slap me on the back of the wrist. But from what I remember, it's very much code-based if you're not using that type of online service. I think there is only that sort of one online service, and it was developed, I think it was developed specifically for that purpose. But yeah, it's very much, you have to know code if you're going to use it. So it's very much a developer's content management system.
And so is that the kind of thing that would probably make sense for a client who the client doesn't need a CMS, but the developer to support the client does?
Yeah, it's a potential option of doing that. It's, again, it comes down very much to, you know, sort of looking at the limitations that come with using a static site generator. And, you know, making an informed choice based on what the client needs, what you need to be able to do with the site. You know, even it comes down to there's a big learning curve with the static site generators. And it's debatable whether for somebody who might only be doing one or two a year, it's debatable whether it's even worth learning it. It might still be, you know, sort of a time benefit and a cost benefit to just build them statically. And I mean, ultimately, that's sort of a big part of what was behind that post as well, is sort of looking at, you know, sort of whether or not CMS is required from a perspective of you're spending a lot of time hooking these systems mm-hmm. into your static designs.
Right.
But if they're never being used and the client isn't any more the wiser, mm-hmm. you're effectively leaving money on the table by spending that time hooking it in. I mean, I went through a phase where I was working with WordPress where I was every single part of the website had to be editable through ACF or CMB2. And mm-hmm. I realized very quickly that nobody was using that.
Yeah.
And effectively, I was shooting myself in the foot. I was taking my average earnings from about $70 down to about $45 an hour. So, and like I said, there was no benefit. The client wasn't any the wiser. So the only person who was really losing out was me.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a really useful conversation because I can honestly say that since I've been working with CMSs, I don't think to not use a CMS. And frankly, most of our clients, while they are small businesses, who are heavily invested in digital marketing. So they are updating regularly. But I think this is a good question that we should include and a good angle that we should include when we're asking questions during the sales process, because you're absolutely right. I can build a site faster just doing my front end expertise than I can when I have to hook it into a CMS. And so if that's something that would actually make sense for a business, then that means we can use their budget more effectively for something else.
Exactly. I mean, I sort of take the approach of if they're not updating the site any more than once or twice a year, then absolutely no question about it, go static. Mm-hmm. If they are creating exactly the same or creating new pages that are exactly the same as another page and it's quicker for you to effectively duplicate that page, make a couple of changes, you know, keep it within version control, because of course that's the other beauty of keeping things entirely static is it makes version control a breeze. Mm-hmm. It just means that you can quickly change those things. Of course, it does mean that, you know, you need a developer to do it. And as some people pointed out, is that really the best use of a developer's time? But it comes down to that thing of a cost benefit ratio of how much stuff needs changing in those pages. And if it's only a small amount, say like, you know, the background image needs changing, the title needs changing, and the body text needs changing, well, then you can use something like Byword to basically drop everything in, mark it all up using Markdown, and then you press, I think it's Control-Alt-P, and it converts it all to PHP. You copy it, drop it in, and hey, presto, that's sorted. So, you know, there's a couple of people who I have still managing in terms of their sites where they are literally just static sites. My soon-to-be wife's website is entirely static. And it means that whenever I need to change anything, I just pull down the latest copy of the repo, do that, put whatever I need to put into Byword, and then, you know, sort of export it and drop it in. And, you know, realistically, it takes me maybe, I don't know, say 5 minutes to change or edit a page. Whereas, you know, for me to have hooked all that into a content management system, right, it could have taken me hours. So, you know, the reality is I'm never going to justify spending that time hooking in a CMS mm-hmm. to that site. But, you know, that's not true for everything. And like you said, it is very much a case of looking at what they're doing, how customizable they need it, and, you know, sort of taking that decision going from there. I mean, the one thing I will say is never try and do a blog statically. I did it for 3 months. It is the most painful thing that you will ever experience as a developer, apart from maybe, like, you know, they always joke saying the two hardest things in front-end development are cache busting and naming things. Make that the third most painful thing is trying to do a blog statically, especially with all the open graph stuff. But yeah, it's one of those.
Well, let's take a little bit of a step back. So I think one of the things that I'm hearing and I think make complete sense is that, you know, when you're in the early discussions with a potential client and you can, you know, take a look at their current website and see if they're blogging or putting news articles or case studies or whatever and getting a sense of how frequently it's updated. But what are your questions for someone who is new to having a website? There are still small businesses out there that haven't gone online, may want to go online. What are the kind of questions you ask to kind of get a sense of their business needs when they may not even know what they are yet for the web?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, it comes down to actually just completely ignoring the web in this situation and just saying, let's do a deep dive into your business. Let's have a look at what your revenue for the last 12 months was, you know, what you are looking to achieve. Is that feasible? If it is, you know, let's look at ways that we can do that without necessarily even investing in a website, you know, Facebook adverts better for them, you know, using some kind of landing pages tool like Lead Pages. You know, it's about trying to avoid sort of defaulting to the comfortable space and going, oh yeah, let's build your website. If it's not really necessary, then, you know, you're effectively shooting yourself in the foot. And what's more, if that person then feels, you know, a year or two down the line, like they've been sort of conned effectively,
yeah, right,
that they've spent this money, yep, and they haven't really seen a benefit from it, then, you know, it damages your business, because every person who runs a business knows at least one other person that runs a business. And that's a referral that you've lost over 2-3 years. It's potentially 10 referrals that you've lost. So it comes down to that. But equally, what I'd say as well is it's sort of helping them realize that a website is a bit like an ice cream truck. You know, I can sell you an ice cream truck, but if you don't buy stock, i.e. content, and put it in the right place, you know, sort of the sharing and the advertising, then nobody's going to buy ice cream from you. And that's not my fault. You know, that's your fault. You know, and it's sort of making them realize that it's not like the early 2000s where, you know, the marketing plan was, hey, have a website and you'll make tens of thousands of dollars. You know, it doesn't work like that. And I think more and more people are sort of coming to that realization. And it's sort of helping those people who are maybe a little bit sort of slow getting onto the web realize that that just isn't the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to put out there that it seems like when you're getting into these conversations about the business, a lot of things that business people are really concerned about is control. And I think that's what CMSs could give them, because I do feel like a lot of clients that go to us, like Emily and I, specifically say they're tired of always contacting a developer to change every little thing. So even if it is something small, would you say that a CMS is still relevant for a client that really wants that type of control over every aspect of their business?
Yeah. So there's a couple of points there. The first one being, this is the reason why WordPress is, or one of the major reasons why WordPress is seen as, you know, sort of the number one content management system in the world. If you think about it, back in the days before, you know, so we automatically assume that content management systems were something that had to go on a website, most people's brochure parts of their website were entirely static. And then they suddenly had these blogs that they could edit, and that it was a revelation to them. And I remember, you know, sort of my dad having this kind of thing, you know, sort of saying, oh my God, I can change all this and do that. And, you know, why can't I do this to the rest of the website? And I think WordPress was in the right place at the right time to sort of capitalize on that. And it's one of the reasons why it's sort of bloated beyond what it actually is, which is a blogging platform. And, you know, it's one of those things where you sort of need to take a step back and sort of say, okay, right, why do you want that control? What is it about paying out for, you know, a developer that you don't like? You know, is it just because you see them as a cost and there's no cost benefit? Well, if that's the case, is that because what you're getting them to do actually isn't having any return to the business? If it's more about, you know, sort of them perceiving you as a cost base, then one thing that the developer can do is, you know, sort of reposition their relationship as an outsourced, you know, sort of part of their business. You know, you don't just work for them, but you are an integral part of their business, and you are effectively an outsourced employee. So rather than just being that annoying nerd who you've got to ring up and poke with a stick several times to try and get them to do this stuff, they start to see you more as an employee, and, you know, sort of stop seeing you as, you know, sort of a cost. And then, you know, you've got flip sides as well. You know, one of the things that I'm doing at the moment, the company that I work at is investigating alternatives to WordPress. That's not to say that we're going to get rid of WordPress, but it's just sort of taking a step back and looking at, you know, so what are the options out there for sort of controlling the front end. And we do regularly have new subdomains and new sites spun up all the time whenever we start a partnership with someone. So, you know, we are a classic example of a company that has a genuine need for a content management system. But it's taking a step back and saying, do they need the full power of WordPress, or mm-hmm. do they need the full power of Craft or Statamic, or, you know, one of the other multitudes of CMSs that are out there as options? And looking at things like, I can't remember the name of the module or the plugin off the top of my head that Jack was talking about.
Workflow? Was it called Workflow?
I think it might be, yeah. Sorry, Jack, if that's not right, please. Yeah, it's sort of identifying exactly what it is that they're frequently changing and trying to, you know, sort of make mm-hmm. sure that whatever you deliver to them gives them the current control that they want without, you know, opening their site up to security risks, or, you know, open them up to, you know, sort of vandalizing their own sites. Because mm-hmm. how many times have we put up a beautiful site, you know, that has had an immense amount of UX work put into it, you know, an immense amount of care to make sure that it matches their brand. And then we go back and it looks like something that's crawled from under, you know, a yes. rock in 2000, you know, and sort of come off MySpace, you know. Yeah. It's that type of thing of, you know, sort of looking at how do you balance the two things.
Yeah. I think that's such an important aspect when you're reviewing a site, like what needs to be edited and who needs to edit it. Because I feel like, especially in the CMS world or just in the development world, there's a tendency to over-engineer things and make everything dynamic and everything editable just because you can. But simply asking, well, if they just need to edit this sidebar section, then perhaps that's all that needs to be done. And I feel like, especially when you are focused on performance on your site as well, the least dynamic the page is, the better. And I believe that's a conversation Emily and I have with our clients on a regular basis too, when they're like, oh, can we edit this? And we usually say, hey, do you need to edit it on a regular basis? Or is this something you're going to just change in like 1 year or 3 years? Because if that's the case, then I'm just going to hard code it in the template and it'll be faster. Yeah. And usually they agree on the latter suggestion versus the, I just need this new field.
Yeah, our clients really do respond. I think we've done a good job of educating existing clients about speed and performance. And our clients are also really comfortable asking us to make those one-off changes here and there, which is a good segue to our next question about like retainer agreements. But before we get into that, I do have a comment / question, but I kind of feel like what Leia was describing, where we have clients that are asking for more control and you know, they don't want to have to ask a dev for help all the time. To me, that's a flag that their business is growing and they are not a fit for what they have right now. And so maybe if they had a static site originally or whatever the situation is, that reflects a growing pain, you know, that's really an opportunity to reevaluate where they are, not just give them a CMS kind of thing, but that it's a signal to something bigger.
Yeah. I mean, probably going back to one of the earlier questions where you were asking about somebody who's brand new, you know, hasn't had a website before. I think a static site is the perfect example mm-hmm. of, I hesitate to call it a minimum viable product because I know it's not the same kind of logic behind it. But if we call it, say, a minimal viable site, it's about identifying what they need as a priority and getting that up there. You know, I think people sort of underestimate how valuable those, hey, new website coming soon type thing, you know, type placeholder websites actually are. Because if you think about it, a lot of businesses only really need the digital equivalent of a Yellow Pages ad. Mm-hmm. And that's what they are. They literally have a, hey, here's our name, here's what we do, here's our contact details. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. Because if you're talking about, you know, sort of somebody who is aware of who the company is and they're looking for details, that's all they need. You know, not everybody sort of wakes up and sort of says, today, I need to get my garden done. I'm going to go and search on Google. A lot of people don't do that. You know, a lot of people would ask their friends and family, oh, who do you have, you know, who does your garden? Or, you know, who, give an example, we've literally just had fence panels in the back of our garden replaced. And the people who are our neighbors who actually sort of instigated that actually asked their friends and family first, and the people who were a recommendation from them. And, you know, now that they've done that, you know, we've seen the high quality of the work and we're actually having them do a couple of bits and pieces in our garden. And that's sort of, you know, recognizing that that's the way a lot of business works is crucial. You know, I think sometimes we get sucked into this idea that the web is everything, you know, business doesn't happen unless it happened on the web. And that's just not the case. You know, it's sort of, I think a lot of the time people neglect such an crucially important type of website. You know, you've got your obvious ones like e-commerce and lead generation websites, but your brochure website these days is more of a confidence website. You know, they probably know who they are. They've probably been recommended. At that point, they're already ready to buy. They just want that little bit of confidence or the ability to contact them. And so you don't need to go over the top with those type of things. And it's, like I say, it's coming up with the minimal viable website that will enable that person to do that. But like you said, if it works and it helps their business grow, there is going to come a point where that doesn't fit them anymore. And that's when you can start having a real conversation about why they need to invest in a new website rather than, you know, sort of what some people do, which is ring them up after 3 years and say, oh, hey, your website looks really rubbish now. You know, it's probably costing you business. Can we redesign it? Well, you know, like I said, we had clients with 8-9 year old websites who were turning over six figures simply because the people who were going on the website didn't care. They were literally looking for a phone number, or they were looking for, you know, sort of a location of how to get to them. It's like I said, it's very much about sort of taking a step back from the technical, the stuff that we really geek out on and we love talking about and thinking about as developers, and actually sort of saying, right, you know, let's take everything a step back and actually look at what the client needs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, effectively, it's a bit of a René Descartes approach of, you know, I think, therefore I am. He stripped everything back when he was questioning things. And that was the question, that was the statement he was left with. I think, therefore I am, so I can build everything up. I can use the scientific method. And while obviously it's not anything as complicated as that, you know, sort of taking a step back from all the sort of ornamental fluff that is the core part of our job, but is completely irrelevant to a business person. It means that we can actually take a deep dive and actually look at what it is exactly that they need.
Yeah, I like this because I feel up until this conversation that Leah and I have done like a superior job of not being prescriptive when we are first engaging with a lead or speaking with a client about something new they want to do, that we really do try to come to it with their business first focus. But this conversation makes me realize we haven't gone that far. We haven't stripped that final layer. We are always assuming a CMS is involved.
It's an easy thing to do. I mean, for me, I only came to that realization when I was working for that agency and, you know, had the occasional ticket come through of, oh, can you change this address? And asking the sales guys, why haven't we sold a new website to this person? It's not responsive. It's not, you know, that. And they just turned around and said, they don't care. It makes them money. It does what they need them to do. Yeah. You know, they pay us a hosting fee every year. You know, if they need to change something, they pay us for an hour of our time to change it. They don't need to worry about it. It just sits there, you know, and does its job effectively.
But in regards to that, though, I do feel like a lot of people in our industry are moving away from clients like that, mostly because they are not as profitable. You'd have to do a volume amount of those types of clients in order to make, you know, a lot of profit. And in your article, you mentioned a retainer agreement. And I feel like the thing that I'm having a hard time wrapping my mind around is that these less profitable clients are inclined to do a monthly retainer. Like, am I completely wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. I think if we approach them with the traditional idea of what we consider to be a monthly retainer, they're incredibly hostile to it. Mm. And one thing I actually found interesting and that I learned when I was working at the agency that had many, many clients is that there were two very, very distinct types of client. The ones who were invariably willing to spend money on retainers, spend money on marketing, the money that they were spending was the business's money. The ones who were much tighter were spending their own money. Mm. Now, whether that was because they were a sole trader and the money that the business had and their own money was one and the same, or whether they just weren't very professional in the way that they handled their business's finances, you know, that's up for debate, but, you know, it was a big thing to note. And like I said, if you approach them in the traditional sense of saying, oh, hey, guys, you know, we've built this website for you for $500. You know, by the way, you need to pay us $50 a month if you want to make any changes. Well, you know, of course, that's going to rub them up the wrong way. Where I was going to go a little bit differently, I'd had a lot of very positive feedback before I was approached by Bigmo, was going down the route of, I'm not entirely sure how you describe it to people to make it clear in their mind what it was, because I never really got that far, but it was very much a website as a service. So rather than paying upfront for the development, what you effectively did is say to them, okay, it's like your mobile phone contract. You know, your mobile phone is absolutely, or your cell phone contract, I think it's in the US. You are locked in for 2 years. You have to do that, or you have to pay a penalty to, you know, sort of get out of it. But in theory, you don't have to pay anything up front. You get the phone, and then, you know, the minutes and the data that you get is what you're effectively getting as a value add, or what you're actually paying for over the course of the 2 years. And it's saying to them, you know, rather than spending, say, $500 up front, how about you change that from a capital expense to an operational expense of $100 a month or $75 a month over the course of, you know, sort of 2 years? Say $100 is $2,400. You know, that's immediately $2,400 that you've made from that one client who reluctantly probably spent $500 with you, because what they're seeing is they've got a website, they can put it against what they're making a month rather than it being an outlay. And then, you know, effectively, they can send over a request through a ticketing platform for you to change something. And you know, it actually gives you a really beneficial way of saying, right, we've got a service level agreement for our basic plan, which is what most of them would end up on. We'll make the changes within a week. You know, most are fine with that. You know, you can make some sort of caveats, like I was going to, where if they've been a bit naughty and they've done something that, you know, they shouldn't have and they need to change it for legal reasons, you know, we'll change it for at absolutely no cost to them for, you know, within 24 hours. You know, if other things as well to make them a little bit more confident, which are things like, you know, if you want to cancel that contract, you've got to pay an exit fee. But if your business closes, you know, there's nothing to pay. Because at the end of the day, that's stressful enough as it is. That also removes the fear of locking themselves in for 2 years. And it also means that effectively they have a relationship with you. How many times have we built websites and then gone away and 6 months later we go back and check up on the website and we think we haven't heard from them? Like Jack said, you know, they've replaced it with a WordPress website. You know, it's that type of thing of having that retainer and sort of shifting the way that people actually pay for these things makes it more of an ongoing relationship. And it's just sort of trying to look at it from their perspective of, this is a big capital outlay to someone who is paying out of it out of their own money. You know, if they only make, say, $1,500 a month, $500 website is a third of what they take home. And it's sort of having it in that sort of mentality that was the idea of having a retainer and sort of how you make those clients profitable.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is kind of blowing my mind. I like the perspective of that cell phone contract situation. And I've heard about this before. I believe someone in the Expression Engine Pro Network does this specifically for nonprofits, where in the overall cost of the website, when you add it up for the 2 year contract or 3 year contract, it ends up being what a quote normal website costs, but they just divide it in months. And they don't do like a deposit or anything like that. It's just you sign the contract, you're going to guarantee this much, and then you're just going to get a monthly outlay. But then like at the end of the day, obviously, that ends up being the total cost of quote real website you would do anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, there's also other benefits to people. Obviously, it means that at least at first, it's going to be slow. You know, you might have less money coming in. But let's say you bring, and let's say within a year, you have managed to get two people on every month. That's $2,400 a month coming in. You know, it's that type of thing of saying, you know, can you say with any certainty that you have $2,400 coming in every month without you actually having to go out and, you know, sort of find clients to do that type of thing. There's nothing to say that you can't carry on doing your existing type of project-based stuff, but it gives you that all-hallowed, holy grail of residual income without trying to find people who are looking for SEO or looking for, you know, sort of PPC when they're not our core areas.
Right.
You know, and we're never going to do it as well as somebody who actually specializes in doing that. It's one of those things of looking at how do you sort of find residual income within what you actually do as a specialty.
Well, and the other benefit I've noticed is that it gives you a continual relationship with this particular client so that it gives you a reason to always contact them, et cetera, and so forth on a regular basis. And you never know what type of business will grow. And since you already have that ongoing relationship, if they have a larger project in mind, as their business grows, then you're the first person of contact.
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the things that I see working inside a startup now, without obviously going into too many details. When you actually reach out and talk to people, you get business from it.
Yeah.
But if you just let them, you know, sort of languish, then yeah, you get business from them, but it's not as great a return. And I think it's something that a lot of web developers and designers do very badly is keeping in touch with their clients. And I know Paul Boag over from the podcast often says that, you know, it's incredibly important to just reach out and just have a 5-10 minute chat with your client every so often. Curtis McHale as well, I think, was advocating the idea of setting up calendar reminders. I think he uses a piece of software that does it for him, but Contactly or something like that. But effectively, it just sends out. You know, you can send it, set it up in MailChimp potentially as a plain text email if you want to make it look a little bit more like you've actually written it. That just basically goes out and says, hey, first name, I haven't heard from you for a while. Hope everything's going okay. You know, it'd be great to have a 5-minute catch up just to make sure that everything's going okay with the website and the business. You know, hope everything's good and speak to you soon. You know, and it's that type of thing. It's really simple. Maybe there's an element of some of us being terrible at time management. I can't not put my hands up and say that I am amazing at time management. And, you know, we've all done it. We've all been an ostrich and we've all stuck our head in the sand when, you know, time things are not going well. And, you know, sort of we've got to speak to the client, deliver them bad news. And maybe that sort of thing we feel sours a relationship when we're afraid to follow up after that. But, you know, sort of having that, having an approach where you're, you know, sort of in constant contact with the people, you'll often find that they genuinely don't care. They just want it done. If you tell them, look, really sorry, such and such has happened, unless they've got a firm deadline like a trade show or an event, most of the time they can afford to let it slip a week, 2 weeks after what you initially said. They're not going to suddenly, you know, flip the desk and lunge at you and, you know, try and grab your neck through the phone. You know, they're like us. You know, if what I often find is useful is putting yourself in the shoes of, you know, somebody else. Imagine you work with a copywriter and the copywriter has a problem that means that they're going to be a week delayed. You know, you're like, okay, yeah, thanks for letting me know. Now I've got to let the client know. But it's one of those things sometimes thinking to yourself, I've got to now let them know. Just take a step back, realize that it's just business, it's life, things like this happen. And as long as you actually tell them in advance, they'll be happy. That avoids a lot of issues.
Yeah, and I think having the retainer relationship or long-term relationship, however you make that happen, makes that easier. Like when we have retainer clients, we talk to them every week, regardless of whether there's something
deliverable.
And that just makes it easier to talk to them. Because I literally did what you just described on Friday. I took the day off on Friday and completely forgot that I had scheduled to bring some client stuff live on Friday night. So at the last minute, I, you know, notified that client. It was no problem. And probably not only because this client's great, but because we talk to them every week. They know we're working. They know we're on top of things. So
exactly. I think that's, and again, coming back to, you know, sort of the mystical arts and black magic of web development. The reality is that just a lot of clients have got no idea what we do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're all being honest, sometimes we don't know what we're doing. But, you know, it's one of those things where communication is key. And whether you do that, you know, on a contract basis or whether you do that on a retainer basis or whether you just do that, somebody who you sold a website to, you know, 2 years ago, you haven't heard from them. Just, you know, if there's one thing that you do after this podcast is just find somebody who you haven't spoken to for a while, give them a ring and see how they are. You know, you never know, you might actually end up getting some business out of it.
Yeah, totally.
I definitely think it's so important to do that constant contact. Cause you, again, like you said, you never know. Like one of our clients right now is someone that I met at a random non-business event and was just, you know, kept in touch on LinkedIn. And then all of a sudden they're, you know, years later, they're a client.
So we're nearing the end of the podcast, but I did want to ask a couple additional questions about the topic about needing a CRMS or not. Do you ever encounter a situation where a client is coming to you and they're saying, I need a CMS, or they're saying, I need WordPress or whatever? What kind of conversation do you have with them to backtrack them away from that perspective to get, you know, first to the business goals?
So probably the most of the time, if you have anybody saying, I want a CMS, they're never saying, I want a CMS. They always say, I want a WordPress. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I say a WordPress specifically because I think WordPress itself has become such a generic trademark. Although, you know, sort of, I'm pretty sure that the guys like Matt and team over at Automattic probably wouldn't be happy to hear that. But the reality is a lot of people do sort of say, oh, yeah, I want a WordPress website. They don't actually mean they want WordPress. They mean they want a site that they can edit in the same way that you might hoover your living room or, you know, your right. sort of house, or you might, I think, is it, it's a wall filler over there, spackle? I can't remember. Spackle, it's polyfill over. Yeah. So you might spackle your walls. You're not actually, that's not the term. It's just, it's become such a generic trademark that, you know, people use it to describe the action. And in the same way, I've found that WordPress has become that sort of generic trademark within our industry of somebody who wants to edit it. So it's a case of just saying to them, okay, so is it that you want to be able to edit your website? Okay, right. Well, why do you want to be able to edit your website? Okay. So say like they turn around and they say, well, we're spending a fortune on our web developer at the moment and we don't feel like we're getting a return. Then it's a case of then steering it back to, okay, do you mind if I ask how much you're paying for that web developer? You know, what are the type of things that they're doing? You know, how does that fit within what you want to do as a business? And sort of you steer it back ever so gently to the point where you'll find the majority of times that you speak to a business owner about business things, A, they love it. You know, let's be entirely honest, people love talking about themselves and their companies. You know, sort of steering away from the thing that they're nervous about, which is web development, and taking it more towards what they feel more comfortable about. You'll find that you really don't, you're not pushing against a brick wall there. You will find it's far, far, far easier than what you ever imagined to get a business person to talk about their own business. And it's sort of steering the conversation in that way away from particular platforms or particular technical decisions that you'll find that you end up getting a far better understanding of what the goal is. Chances are, you know, with those type of clients, you probably will end up using a CMS. And, you know, one thing I will say as a takeaway from this is don't ever think that I'm saying don't use a CMS at all. It's just more about taking a step back and rather than jumping in. And, you know, another example would be, hey, yeah, let's use React. You know, so few websites need React, and even yes. the ones that do are arguably better suited with, like, you know, Vue or something. It's more about sort of getting people to take a step back and actually question, right, okay, stop thinking about technical things. You know, in the WordPress space, it might be, oh, I can use this template. It's about taking a step back and sort of focusing on why that person's speaking to you and, you know, sort of really rethinking the approach that you're actually taking to building that website.
So I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. We noticed your own site is, it looks like it's running on Statamic.
Yep.
Why did you choose a CMS for your site? Is it because you have a blog? Because it's relatively minimalist.
I think it's minimalist both in design, which is the default Redwood theme. I am one of those people who is incredibly picky. And I just figured, you know what? I want a really nice, clean theme. The Redwood theme is that. Let's go with that. In terms of having a blog, it's my personal objective to write more. After 10 years of being a journalist, I hate writing, if I'm being entirely honest.
I know the feeling.
Yeah. So, you know, it's sort of having that. But then also, you know, it comes down to the fact that, you know, we're investigating different options. Like I said before, you know, sort of getting my hands on the guts of Statamic means that I can try a couple of different things. There's a lot of pages that aren't public or have, you know, sort of redirects on there that you can't publicly access on that site that are test beds for me to play around with things without being necessarily public in a way that I can access it on my various, you know, sort of test devices and stuff. So yeah, I mean, that's really sort of why I went with Statamic. It's the one that we're testing at the moment. I've had websites like that on WordPress. I've had them on Craft. I've had them on Perch. It's just, you know, again, I might be the one who says don't use a CMS, but I'm addicted to, you know, trying different CMSs again. So it's one of those. It's part scratching my own itch, part scratching my work itch, and, you know, part just trying to actually blog more.
Fair. So to wrap this up, do you have any final advice for clients deciding whether they need a CMS or not?
For clients, I would say take a step back from thinking about technical things. When you start talking to a web developer or a web designer or an agency, that's not the time to be talking about technical things. You're effectively taking the approach, and it was one of the project managers I used to work with, and I love this saying. It's like saying, I know where I'm getting married. I know when I'm getting married. Now I just need to find my wife. Yeah. I'm sure it's probably a saying that's quite common, but far too often when we start talking to clients, both they and we are rushing into that sort of trap. And it's about taking a step back and actually working out, well, for one, are you actually the right fit for each other? But also, you know, sort of taking a deep dive and looking at where the things are in the business that, you know, sort of you can help with. And then once you've got those answers, starting to think about the technical solutions that effectively can help them with those problems.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any advice for developers as they decide whether or not it's worth it to implement a CMS or not for a client?
Yeah. If you have only ever used one CMS, please, this year, try a different one.
Yes. Amen.
Yes. Please, if you've only ever worked with open source content management systems, that be that WordPress or Drupal, please try a commercial one. If anything, and I'm not saying that you should go breaking any copyright laws, but you might learn something that can benefit your own open source system. Believe it or not, the premium paid for CMSs are light years ahead of any of the open source content management systems that are big and popular on the market at the moment. And there's a reason for that. They're focused. They're aware of what they need to do, and they don't try to be everything to everyone. Go and try them. Get your head around how they work. And then once you've got a better understanding of, A, what they do, what the options are out on the market, you are better placed to actually help clients and, you know, even other developers to, you know, sort of make the most of the tools that we are absolutely incredibly fortunate to have. Because let's face it, if some genius hadn't come up with the idea of a content management system, we'd still be doing everything statically right now, probably. And yeah, like I said, blogging statically, not a good idea.
Fair. Well, that's all the time we have for today. But before we finish up, we've got our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better. Are you ready, Ben?
I am.
Okay, first question. Introvert or extrovert?
Ooh, about 10 years ago, I'd have said an introvert, but being a journalist kind of forces you to be an extrovert.
The power is going to be out for the next week. What food from the fridge do you eat first?
The cheese, probably.
Yum.
Could be the bacon, could be the cheese. I'd probably end up trying to work out some way of making something together with them.
What's your favorite website for fun?
Fun. Probably Reddit.
What's the last thing you read?
User experience designed by Paul Boag.
What's the best piece of professional advice you've received?
This comes from one of the guys I used to work for in Dubai. There are no such thing as stupid questions, only stupid people who don't ask questions.
I like that. What's the worst piece of professional advice you've received?
Oh, that is actually a good one. Use WordPress. It's perfect. It'll do everything.
What's your favorite color?
Probably green.
If you could take us to one restaurant in your town, where would we go?
Oh, good question. I would probably take you across the river to Liverpool and take you to a restaurant called Etsu. You know it's very, very good food when you go in there, and the place is full of Japanese people, even though you're in Liverpool. So
what's your favorite board game?
Favorite board game is definitely Battlestar Galactica. Not that I get to play it very often, because obviously it is a 6 to 8 hour long board game. So if we're sort of going for a shorter game, it'll probably be something like Settlers of Catan.
I love that game. I love that.
All right, too. Last question. Hulu or Netflix?
As we can't get Hulu over here.
Oh, you guys can't? I didn't know that.
No. I suppose the equivalent for us would be the BBC, or, you know, sort of one of the multitude of different ones. Yeah, I'd probably say I'm going to go with Netflix, just because obviously I don't want to go sort of twisting the answer.
All right. Thank you, Ben.
Okay. Thank you very much.
This is a great conversation. In case our listeners want to follow up with you or send you questions, where can they find you online?
Probably the easiest way of getting a hold of me online is Twitter, and my handle is FrontEndBen, as in FrontEnd Developer. The other way of getting a hold of me is probably going on my website, benthurphy.co.uk, and dropping me a message through the contact form.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for reaching out to us with this idea in your article, because I think this was a really useful discussion.
Yeah, and thanks for having me on.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Many thanks to Backup Pro.
We'd also like to thank our hosting partner, Arcus Tech.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Click Cast, or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both. And if you really like this episode, consider donating to the show. Links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode, when we're going to talk about Google Analytics with Terry Jenkins. Be sure to check out controlclickcast.com/schedule for more upcoming topics.
This is Leia Alcantara.
And Emily Lewis.
Signing off for Control Click Cast. See you next time.
Cheers.